Before we begin, I want to say that both of you are to be congratulated for coming to couples therapy. A lot of married couples just give up, especially when they have the kind of age disparity you're dealing with.
No, we're the same age, but he got on a spaceship 40 years ago and he just came back and he never got older because of relativity.
I see. You might have walked in the wrong door here at the clinic. This is couples therapy. I think you want the door marked really crazy people.
No, she's right. I got on a spaceship. It was so amazing. They took me to a planet where everybody was a window.
I don't want to hear about your stupid window people. You want to know what happened back here while you were talking to windows? My mother was stepped on by a cow and died from internal hemorrhages.
Could I just point out that Ronnie was the one who left me?
Because you kept building huge mounds of poop in our house.
They were geological formations.
The question is, can you step back into your old roles?
I want to. I want to be active in my kids' lives.
Your kids' lives? Let me tell you about your kids' lives. Sylvia is a vice chair of the Indiana State Republican Committee. Toby is a Scientologist. And Brad is a 32-year-old woman.
Who didn't see that coming?
Okay, I think our time is up.
That's fine, because Roy, I made a life without you. Okay, dating Phil Spector for 5 years was maybe a mistake, but it was a life. And it was mine. And now a bunch of strangers are about to talk about us on the radio, so here he is, the man who played nerve guest sheep number 3, Colin McEnroe.
We are going to talk about them. They're the Neary family, immortalized in Close Encounters of the Third Kind, which is 40 years old right now, hence a re-release of Close Encounters. It'll be in the second part of our show today. We all went to the movies and saw it. When I say we, I mean the nose. And when I say the nose today, I mean Rebecca Castellani, entertainment director at Bridge Street Live in Canton, Connecticut, Collinsville specifically, the Montmartre of Connecticut, and James Hanley, co-founder of Cine Studio at Trinity College, and Bill Usman, director of the Media Literacy and Digital Culture Graduate Program at Sacred Heart University. So that's what we're going to be talking about then. Here at the beginning, we're going to, I think, sort of try to combine a few things that happen marginally related to the world of sports. Although we are not a sports show, don't pretend to be experts in sports, and some of us really don't pretend to be experts in sports. But that doesn't matter because it doesn't really have anything to do with that. What we really had this week was two ways in which America's incredibly fraught and taut relationship towards race popped out in the world of sports. One of them was in Fenway Park, where four fans were ejected in Boston after they unveiled an anti-racism banner over the so-called Green Monster. That's the big green wall in left field in Fenway Park, for those of you who don't follow these things. Umpire Joe West consulted with the police and security about the sign because it was in fair territory. It was taken down, and the fans were removed peacefully within minutes. There were no arrests made. Meanwhile, Jemele Hill, one of the anchors on ESPN, got into trouble because she was tweeting very negative things about Donald Trump and his relationship to white supremacy. We can go into a little bit more detail about that as we move along here. The White House actually called for her firing, which I actually – well, anyway, we'll come to that too. She had to make a sort of apology, although not to the White House. So all of those things are sort of swirling around together, and it's maybe we need to take one at a time, and then we can sort of figure out what it is that they have in common. Or maybe they're sort of opposite images of each other. So Rebecca, as a person with a great deal of scholarly training in literature, I think we have to look at the banner. It says, racism is as American as baseball. I think this is a badly drafted banner here.
Yes. It's a badly worded and badly executed in terms of the graphic design. I certainly, at first blush, thought that this was pro-racism. It was like, it's just like baseball. Everybody does it. What's a little racism? And I especially think I took issue with the graphic design because the S and the E of baseball looked to me pushed together in a way that just – I think I'm just seeing things now because I'm so disturbed by the moment we're in. But I thought it looked a little swastika-esque. So my initial gut was that was what this was. And then it took me reading an article about it to realize these people were actually protesting racism. So I think, you know, next time you make a sign, maybe be a little clearer because – or maybe that was their point. That is the other thing that occurred to me afterwards is that they maybe – did this on purpose.
Look, if they did it on purpose, what would their point be?
That it's hard to tell these days what people's messages are. And it could be very much, you know, I think 5 years ago, nobody would have read this banner and said, you know, obviously they're saying racism is American as baseball, not in favor of racism. But now I think things have gotten a little more convoluted for people.
Right. It's hard to tell. That would be a good banner, too. Just put that out.
You know, yeah.
That might even be more effective. Although, let's go to our media studies expert here. I mean, it does sort of – you had the same ambiguity anyway, right, when you first looked at this banner?
I personally didn't, but I understand why a lot of people did. For me, I instantly understood what they were saying because that's what I write about.
Yeah.
You know, that this idea that there's nothing exceptional about racism. Racism is ordinary. Racism is a normal, everyday part of existence in the United States. The country was founded on racist principles, despite the rhetoric of the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. And so it was kind of pointing out that if we're really going to address this, we have to address what this nation really is all about. But I do understand why other people found that ambiguous, and I think it's related to the larger context that we're living in now, where white supremacist disruption is becoming so common that I can understand why someone would look at that and say, oh gosh, is this a white supremacist disruption? Are they trying to say a an endorsement of racism as American because, you know, it tastes good just like apple pie does?
Hey, James, what were you going to say?
Well, I was going to say I think that the root of that is kind of the equivalency, the attempt of white supremacy and all of the things that go along with it to be given an equivalency so that this is something that, okay, well, it's just as important as somebody saying that racism is bad, that you can actually make an argument that racism is good, that there's a weird sort of sense that out there. I think that I have that fear, you know, that all the time there's a sort of sense that you can legitimize something by even talking about it, by having a discussion and giving it equal status. And I think that that was the creepiest thing about that sign, that I had that momentary thought. I don't think I held it for long, but I did have that creepy thought that, wow, could this be the opposite of what I think it is? And then it's very interesting, Rebecca, what you said about the fonts, you know, that the visual imagery and graphics associated with white supremacy and with racist groups and with all sorts of, you know, repressive groups, the sense of imagery is really confused in a way that some people clearly know how to use the symbols of the past, like to send something out that vaguely suggests a swastika or vaguely suggests some sort of racist symbol. And I'm thinking of hoods, for example, being concealed in fonts, as a matter of fact, and things like that. And so those things are out there. But at the same time, there are some extraordinarily stupid things, sort of like, you know, the racist marchers in Charlottesville buying their tiki torches at Walmart. Mm-hmm. And completely failing to see any sort of, you know, like, could this perhaps be confusing your image, you know? Much as they are, you know, obnoxious people, I think, this sort of imagery is there. And I find it creepy in the sense that it sort of creeps into your sense of the world, that you start to feel that things are being given legitimacy out of your control.
Mm-hmm.
That somehow you can't stop this retaining a kind of legitimacy, those ideas.
The people who, the group that did this, and their name is White People Are Great, question mark? No, that's not really their name. But that would be an indication of what their problem is. They said that they're kind of doing like a Harold Bloom thing. They're blaming the reader. They said, we don't think of it as an ambiguous message. It's kind of telling that it is being interpreted as one. You're nodding?
Yeah, I think it is telling that it's being interpreted that way. I think that, you know, we are in a very sensitive moment right now where people, it's, you know, it's all at a trigger pull and it's nerve-wracking.
I have to say, like, it kind of reminds me when I'm out in public, anytime I see someone wearing a red hat, I'm instantly looking to see if it's a MAGA hat. And I can feel the bristles on the back of my neck.
Or a pussy hat. It could be either way, right? Hats have gotten very political. Right. The one thing I brought up in the emails, and I could be the only one who thinks about it this way, but I was also thinking about the appropriateness of doing this. Now, obviously, anytime you've got a big stage with TV cameras trained around and stuff like that, there's and I'm a big believer in dissent and protest, although I think usually it should be less ambiguous. But you know, is it a good idea to do this? And is it? I mean, what's the subtext here? Well, the subtext here is that the Boston Red Sox have the worst racial history of any Major League Baseball team. They were the last to integrate. By far, they integrated, you know, years after Jackie Robinson retired. They got their first black player, Pumsey Green. So it's that. It's the notion that even this year that there still are some ne'er-do-wells out in the stands who yell at Adam Jones from the Orioles and yell, you know, racial taunts at him. On the other hand, you sort of think about what I posited was Mookie Betts, who was, I think, the one member of the Red Sox actually quoted about all this. And you think about sort of somebody who's there to do his job, right? He's there to do his job. He's worked really hard to be a good baseball player. He's, I'm sure, very concerned about racism and would like to be in a position to maybe have some interesting conversations, as I think we're going to find athletes doing more and more this year about racism. But he's in a pennant race, you know? And I would find that distracting. Like, I don't really want to have to be thinking about all this. I don't know. James, do the athletes, the African-American, the black athletes who are there trying to do their jobs, they may not really welcome this being turned into a forum about racism.
Well, I don't think I agree. I don't think they welcome it. And I think there are lots of examples of where things are said to be inappropriate. I mean, one that I was personally involved in, I remember, is when a group of lesbian activists unfurled a banner in the Connecticut State Legislature during the fight over rights here in Connecticut. And there were lots of people who said, oh, you just don't do that here. You know, it's a disrespect of the office, of the governor. It's a disrespect of the legislature to act that way. You know, what about demonstrations at the opera? Suddenly having a demonstration about racism in the middle of the Met, you know, stopping an opera, and there's going to be lots of people howling and saying, well, you know, this is not the place to do it. But I would say, if it's not the place, where is the place? Mm-hmm. Yes. And I think that you really have to, I understand, I sympathize with the uncomfortable nature of what happens for people who are on the downside of it. But at the same time, it's really important to grasp the attention when there's a lot of eyes looking. The one thing I would say about these people who put out this banner, if they were trying to do what they say they were doing, was follow up and having sort of background, you know, like throw a bunch of leaflets, you know, have a bale of leaflets and throw it out on the field. Get people's attention and explain a few things rather than just making it look like it's a symbol. But I think disruption of that kind in the most is absolutely essential. It's like, you know, when the king and queen are marching down the road thinking that everybody's adoring them, you know, they get something thrown at them that they don't like the smell of. So, you know, then the conversation inevitably changes.
Don't throw leaflets on the field. That's not a good idea. But I think your point about having some greater context for all this is good. I mean, it's sort of weird. There's something almost, you know, retro about a banner. Here we live in this digital age where everybody is constantly expressing their opinions all the time to the biggest possible audience that they can find. I'm amazed people still even do banners. I'm looking at you, Miss Young Person.
Yeah, I love a good banner. I think it was a very effective image, too. I mean, the Green Giant certainly – is that Green Giant? You can see sports balls.
It's
really not
the green giant.
It's
called the green monster.
The green monster. There
you're
you
thinking
go.
About corn and
yeah,
vegetables.
Yeah, sorry, that's where my head's at. All right, so I just gave my hand away there. Anyways, the green monster is very iconic for everyone that's not me, and to see that black banner unfurled slowly down that wall, I do think was a moment. And I mean, I'm with James. I think that if there are certain places that are not acceptable for protest, those are the places you should start protesting first. Because
true. Although I want to say, in terms of like people who to whom I accord respect, Mookie Betts ranks so much higher than any member of the Connecticut State General Assembly. go ahead. You can unravel any banner you want in front of those people. So let's just circle back here, and maybe we can use it to jump, Bill, over to ESPN, to the point that you were making, which is the point of this banner. And one of the reasons that it wound up being ambiguous is that they are trying to say the thing that you're trying to say, that you can't really talk about racism as an anomaly that can be made discrete from from the flow of American life, that in fact the only way to talk about racism is to talk about it as part of American life. I think that's both your point and their point. Although I'm wondering, how do you really start that conversation? Because I don't know. I guess the fact that we're talking about it maybe means the banner worked.
Yeah, I think the banner did work. And like everybody is talking about this now. When you raise the question of the context in which it happened, Colin, I had a few thoughts related to that. One is, when you first said, well, what about Mookie Betts, who's just like he's trying to do his job. Mm-hmm. He's trying to concentrate. I hadn't thought of it that way before, and I did start to think, well, what if it was something that I would be opposed to? What if it was a performance of Hamilton, for example, and someone unfurled a banner that said Hamilton was white, and that would be a distraction to the people who were performing? That would have bothered me.
It's a great point.
But on the other hand, and just to kind of counter that for a minute, Mookie Betts is a professional athlete, and they have part of what they do is they focus in such a way that they eliminate all those sorts of distractions. I'm not a huge Major League Baseball fan, but I am a huge NBA fan. So I started thinking, when Steph Curry goes up to take a crucial free throw, if he's in a opponent's arena, people are making noise and they've got the thunder sticks and sometimes they unveil giant banners of half-naked women, and yet he has to block all of that out. So I would give Mookie Betts the respect to say that he's fully capable of doing that, and that even more than that, that it's more important to have conversations like this than to worry about whether Mookie Betts is going to be distracted for a few minutes.
Mookie, by the way, said that's for another day when he was talking about the content of the banner, which I take to mean he's happy to have that conversation.
Well, that raises an interesting thing to me, which is that it's really hard to get these conversations started on a real basis because there's such media concentration. There's not an opportunity to have the serious discussion to get it going. And so if you create an event like unfurling a banner, or you disrupt something that is seen as being, you're doing something wrong, is transgressive, and therefore you get the conversation started. I mean, if you think about the massive sports machines and how much money they control and how they try to control the environment, obviously they can't. And so I think it's really important I've certainly gone through times when we first opened Sony Studio, where demonstrations would interrupt the proceedings of selling tickets to come to a movie. These things happened, and we sometimes had things like a teach-in would spontaneously start going on about the Vietnam War prior to a showing of, some Italian neorealist film. And part of me says, wait a minute, we got to show the film at 7:30, but there are other issues there. And it's very hard to raise those issues to enough people. It's kind of like, what about the people who demonstrate about stuff like in West Hartford? They walk out across the street in the middle of the rush hour. And it's really irritating to the system. And people don't want to be delayed in their cars. They don't want to be delayed on their way home. But how do you start that conversation that needs to be had?
All right. So we have to switch gears a little bit here, though. We're not entirely leaving the world of sports. We have to introduce you metaphorically to Judge Jemele Hill, who is the co-host with Michael Smith of ESPN's signature SportsCenter franchise, 6 p.m. Broadcast. And she, in her spare time, had been tweeting about President Trump, specifically tweeting that President Trump is a white supremacist who surrounds himself with white supremacists. As this thing unfolded, she made an apology, not to the White House and not to Donald Trump, but she did apologize, saying that her tweets were her own beliefs and were not necessarily those of ESPN. ESPN also made essentially the same tweet. She said – or the same comment. They said the comments do not represent the position of ESPN. We have addressed this with Jemele, and she recognizes that her actions were inappropriate. But the White House did an unusual thing, which was to suggest that she should be fired. Keep in mind that whatever ESPN does, it falls in the general rubric of journalism. James, I don't know. I'll let you begin to unpack this. any way you choose. Where do you want to begin with the story?
Well, I don't know. I mean, one of the things I'm just thinking of, you know, ESPN being who they are and the Disney people, they have a huge phalanx of lawyers who right. are telling, okay, this is how we should respond, meaning the corporation. And they are thinking in terms of all sorts of things. They're thinking finance. They're thinking, how is this going to impact the bottom line? But they're also thinking, well, you know, supposing we have some white supremacists on our staff, which no doubt they do, that we're going to have to sort of, you know, deal with that as well. And so their interest is in not having any ripples coming. And so how can they shut this down as quick as possible? And one of the ways is to send out a thing saying, well, if you still want to keep your job, say that this was private, this was your private thing, and try and sort of tough it out. But I think it comes again to this issue of how do you raise these issues? I mean, what she is saying is what a lot of people know, which is we do have some very virulent racist ideas that are right in the center of our national government right now. And this is something that is really, you can't deny that. And for somebody to actually raise that and say that and then have a corporation essentially sort of put their thumb on her and say, well, you know, you can't really say that. To me, it's an opportunity, again, to have a conversation, to start paying attention to it seriously. And I admire her for her tenacity and also the fact that she's made it clear in a sort of tacit way that I kind of admire, which is, yes, yeah, I'm really sorry, you know. But I think that people read between the lines about
Oh, yeah,
that.
She's certainly not backing down here.
Right.
I mean, in a way, Bill, this is yet – I mean, we've seen on both sides of the political aisle and every other part of the ideological spectrum – repeats of this story, which is when you're sitting in by your phone or your iPad or your whatever tweeting, who are you and how free are you given whoever else you are to say what's on your mind? And, you know, I mean, I do this a lot too. I tweet a lot of stuff that is not the position of the Connecticut Public Broadcasting Company. But it is a risk that's built into the media these days.
It is a risk. And like James, I also really admire her for doing this. And I agree, like she's sorry, not sorry. I'm absolutely sure of that. And I think of Jemele Hill, you know, coming from my own perspective as a college professor, I see Jemele Hill in the same realm with people like Johnny Eric Williams of Trinity College, who also faced, you know, like this very, very severe backlash for things that he put out on social media. And, you know, there could be a lot of debate about the appropriateness of it or what he was reposting and all of that. But the essential thing for me is that regardless of what profession you're in, whether it's education or media or anything else, you have a right to your freedom of expression. This is what Jemele Hill believes. She didn't say this is what ESPN believes. She didn't try to associate it with Disney in any way. And for her to be, you know, censored for this, and particularly for the White House to intervene and start calling for a private citizen to lose their job over something that was critical to their administration, I think it just really reveals the extraordinary times that we're living in.
I have to say, when I saw that, I emailed you guys this, but when I saw that part of it on Twitter, I mean, I really did have one of those things like on Star Trek where the lights start flashing and the sirens start going on the main deck, and like because it is really unusual. I am literally unable to recall. There might have been a time during the Nixon era. I am unable to recall an instance where the White House in any way called for the firing of a journalist. I mean, this really is – a lot of people misuse the term freedom of speech, at least as it's spelled out in the Constitution. It only really does involve the government attempting to curtail your speech. And if you want to get really specific, it really ultimately means the government – trying to impose its own sanctions on you to curtail your speech. But this really is, to me, this was a real honest-to-God First Amendment incursion. You got the White House. I mean, I feel like
What's it going to take at this point? Every time I come on the show, I'm like, so is this it? Is he going to get impeached now? Like, when? How much longer do I have to wait?
Well, I mean, to the point that Bill and James are making, I mean, if freedom of speech means anything, it means, I mean, we could talk about how Johnny Eric Williams is maybe a little bit different, although we don't have time and we're not going to. But, you know, I mean, if freedom of speech means anything, it means you can call the president a boob or a moron, or whoever the president is, you should be able to do that. You know, I mean, you absolutely should be able to do that, and you shouldn't never lose your job for it. I mean, if this me and it's you certainly shouldn't have the White House calling for you to lose your job. I'm sorry. I'm
no, I do think we do treat the world of sports with kid gloves, though, sometimes, and we want to retain this, you know, bipartisan sports aren't political. That's a lot of what I saw the backlash to Jamel Hills was people saying, you don't bring your politics into sports. Sports is free from that. And I'm sorry, we don't give that same out to any other sphere of common cultural interest like that. This election has encroached into movies, pop culture, everything. Nothing is immune from it. And the people that are not participating in that, looking at you, Taylor Swift, are getting called out for it now. So I do think that it's time for sports to realize that they are one of the largest platforms of viewership in this country. And to maintain this wishy-washy, well, we, you know, every viewpoint, racism isn't cool, full stop. And I think that we can all agree on that. And if you can't agree with that, then, you know, there's no space for you in these public gatherings. I'm sorry.
All right. Taylor Swift did agree to date Colin Kaepernick. So
oh, good. Good.
All right. So we have to do one really quick switch here. This is a really fascinating topic. And I love what you just said, Rebecca, too. And I think also that whole thing is over. I think as you see this football season and the baseball playoffs unfold, you're going to see more and more protests from actual athletes. They're getting pretty motivated about this. But we do have to do a quick switch here. And this is this is a record. We've never talked about the same topic three times, unless you count Donald Trump. But we originally, when a lawsuit was filed by PETA against a wildlife photographer named David Slater, we began talking about this, about the monkey selfie. This is a macaque. I believe a crested macaque who named Naruto. I'm looking at you because you've been in all three discussions. So the photographer set up the camera hoping that maybe a monkey would do something like this. The monkey took a selfie basically, made a really funny face and pressed the button. And then the question became who owned it, who owned the rights to it. It's actually, as these kinds of things go, a sought-after picture. PETA decided to file a suit on behalf of the monkey, leading Carolyn Payne to ask the greatest question ever on the nose, which is, my question is, what is the monkey going to do with the money? Well, anyway, a settlement has been reached. The monkey doesn't really get any money, but monkeys do. Slater's agreed in a settlement to give 25% of the proceeds from online sales of signed pictures, signed by him, not the monkey, to wildlife preservation of especially for monkeys in Indonesia. I believe I've summarized this case. So very quickly, we'll go around the table. And since you are – I think James has been in on at least one of these conversations. Yes. But you've definitely been in on all three. So you get to go first. You have tenure.
I mean, what a resolution finally for all animals across the world, because it's also in this umbrella legislature, artwork created by animals. Elephants is no longer considered something you can have a copyright on. So a big win for the animal kingdom. Do they care? No. Did this monkey care? No. Did this need to go to court? No. And yet here we are. This is 2017. What a time to be alive.
We're going to do what ESPN calls hot takes. James, what's yours?
Well, I'd say that there are so many things that animals need. I'd have given them 50%. I mean, I really think that there's so much need to actually provide facilities to preserve the existence of animals in the midst of this massive extinction that's going on. I think it's a great channel for the money.
Bill Yusman, you may be involved in the final monkey selfie conversation ever had on the nose, but I can't guarantee that.
My hot take is I kind of wish I wasn't part of that discussion. But my favorite part is that there had to be a sentence on CNN.com that said, because the monkey cannot create a copyrightable work, that work can never be copyrightable. Right. That's a classic sentence.
Yeah. Right up there with anything Felix Frankfurter ever said. All right. We're going to take a break. No, I have to do one thing. I don't have time to do this. I just have to quickly tie everything together. The thing that ties everything together is Joe West. And here's how. Joe West is an umpire. I think he's umpired more Major League Baseball games than any active umpire, and maybe more than anybody ever. I don't know. So the way that he ties everything together was he was the guy who ordered the banner removed at Fenway Park. He also was suspended from his job this year because he criticized the very temperamental Adrian Beltre, a third baseman known for arguing with umpires. He says he has a good relationship with Adrian Beltre, but what he said was that he said to Adrian Beltre, "You may be a great hitter, but as an umpire, you stink," because Adrian Beltre was always arguing balls and strikes with him. Okay. And this year at the All-Star Game, a player named Nelson Cruz came to the plate. Joe West was the plate umpire. This man took a camera, actually his smartphone, out of his pocket, handed it to the catcher, Javier Molina, and had a picture taken of himself with Joe West. So, which has never happened before in baseball either. And then put his phone back in his pocket and resumed playing. So that's how you – it wasn't a selfie, but it's close enough. It ties everything together. It's all about Joe West. All right. We have to take a break. Then we'll come back.
Love is monkey see and monkey do, that's all it is, peaches. Love is monkey see and monkey do, would I lie to you?
Here we are. We're back with the nose. In studio is Bill Usman, James Hanley, Rebecca Castellani. They are the nose today. So the reason that we're about to talk about what we're about to talk about next is because Rebecca and I are wimps. Because Jonathan McNichol wanted us to talk about the movie It, and she and I refused to go see it.
Sorry.
So, no, I don't know. Comrades, that's how I say. Yeah. Life is too short. Anyway, instead we're going to be talking about Close Encounters of the Third Kind. It's 40 years old, and they have taken this occasion to re-release the movie. And there are like three or four versions of this movie anyway, so you know, you can go and see it. You'll probably see something you never saw before, including – Did everybody have like the little weird mini documentary at the beginning?
Yes,
of their
I opinion? Did. You know? Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Which I didn't really appreciate, actually. I mean, you're the cinephile.
It
I don't
was
know.
Kind of, yeah. I always find those sort of documentaries, unless they're exceptionally interesting for some sort of oblique reason, they generally, especially playing it before the movie,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
It was kind of totally bogus.
Don't show me stuff I'm about to see and tell me how it was
yeah,
made.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
I don't want
that. I was annoyed by it, too.
Yeah. So don't do that anymore. All right. So for people who don't remember Close Encounters at all, let's hear a little bit right now. I think we're going to hear Francois Truffaut and probably Bob Balaban interpreting for him, which goes on the entire movie. I would assume also Richard Dreyfuss. I'm not sure I even know which clip this is.
Have you recently had a close encounter?
Une rencontre plutôt inhabituelle.
A close encounter with something very unusual.
Who are you people?
And the two of you felt compelled to be here?
Yeah, you might say that.
Mais qu'espériez-vous trouver?
But what did you expect to find?
An answer.
That's not crazy, is it?
Je crois qu'on pourrait les mettre dans l'hélicoptère avec les autres. Je parlerai au Major Walsh.
Il faudrait peut-être vérifier sa crédibilité.
Non, j'ai confiance dans mon intuition. Ces gens-là ont été choisis au hasard. C'était eux, ça aurait pu être d'autres. Ils n'ont rien de spécial. Ils sont simplement trouvés au bon endroit, au bon moment.
Hold it. Is that it? Is that all you're gonna ask me? Well, I got a couple of thousand goddamn questions, you know? I want to speak to someone in charge. I want to lodge a complaint. You have no right to make people crazy. You think I investigate every Walter Cronkite story there is, huh? If this is just nerve gas, how come I know everything in such detail? I've never been here before. How come I know so much? What the hell is going on around here? Who are you people?
All right. So here at this point is someplace out in, I believe, Wyoming, someplace called Devil's Butte or something like that. This is the place where Richard Dreyfuss and other people who have already been exposed to some kind of energy or something from extraterrestrials, they have felt compelled to go. This film is a landmark in science fiction in the sense that it dares to imagine a world in which Richard Dreyfuss is a blue-collar power company worker with some kind of truck that he drives around with little tiny ladders. So anyway, Devil's Tower, that's what it's called. I'm really sorry. So I started with you first last time. I'll start with Bill this time. How did this movie play for you 40 years later?
I was really struck by – so I was 15 when the film first came out. I was really struck by how different my perceptions of it were now as they were then. And, you know, then I was just like, wow, this is super, super cool. And now I'm really seeing it through a complete different lens where I was thinking about – the family relationships, and I was thinking about, you know, whether Richard Dreyfuss was losing his mind. I was thinking about it in terms of conspiracy theories and how much of a conspiracy theory movie it really is, with, you know, the government, you know, leaving the, you know, subdued, you know, sedated animals on the side of the road to try to scare people away from coming to this area. And that, you know, in the days that we're living in, that has a whole another level of resonance for me. And yet, you know, I was also struck by how remarkable really the aesthetics of it were, considering that it's a 40-year-old movie.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, Rebecca, you grew up with a different set of embedded iconographies than the other three of us, because for you, when a really, really large spaceship kind of comes out of the sky and begins hovering over a large chunk of the American landscape, there's really only one thing that's going to happen. Bolts are going to come out of it, mm-hmm. and people are going to die.
Yes.
So in a way, this was one of our – I mean, not that we've never seen an outer space movie before, because obviously all of us had, but – this, I mean, we got benign before we got really toxic. And so how did this play as maybe a young set of eyes coming to it?
Yeah, well, this is the first time I'd actually seen this film. And I watched it with my 22-year-old brother. And he's a man of very few words. And he was very moved by how benevolent everything was, from the characters to the aliens. They were just trying to communicate, you know, in the vein of E.T., which was a film that I saw. That was certainly not my first exposure to science fiction. I would guess my first science fiction film might have been War of the Worlds and, like, the terrible Tom Cruise one, maybe. Mm-hmm. So definitely, I think that there has been a shift for sure in what we want out of a science fiction movie. Though watching this back, it really makes you yearn for that sort of more simple, nostalgic. I mean, the movie felt like the aliens were really there is a secondary device for the greater things that were going on in the plot, whereas now an alien movie, that is it. It is all about the destruction and fleeing the destruction, and you might get separated from your family and your girlfriend might get eaten. But at the heart of the movie, it's about violence and destruction, and that was so far from what this film was about. It was subtle and nuanced, and I was very surprised at how positively I responded to it.
War of the Worlds, of course, the one you're talking about, was also directed by Steven Spielberg. It was clearly James' response to 9/11. 9/11, one of the things we did was inexplicably get mad at France.
Yep.
and so in a way, the international politics of this movie are harder to believe in some ways than the extraterrestrial visit. The notion that some French guy would be placed in charge of everything with total decision-making power was the thing I struggled against the most.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting aspect of it, because that really twits the movie as to what it really is, which is a kind of insider movie in the movie industry, because there's lots of references to other movies. One of the most ironic references actually related to that in terms of it being benign is that conversation clip that you played is actually a joke about the conversation that took place in 2001, A Space Odyssey, between the two astronauts that the computer was listening in on by reading lips. Mm. And the setup of the picture was exactly the same. And, of course, in this case, you had a foreign language being spoken. But there's a further background to this, which is François Truffaut is probably one of the most humanist of directors in the European pantheon, as it were, and constantly was making films about the nature of human existence and survival and how you developed yourself, how you found your place in the world. Everything from 400 Blows, The Wild Child, all of these films had a kind of humanity to them. And it's like Steven Spielberg wanted him in that film because of that. But I think that very, very few people who saw the Close Encounters knew that. And so it did have a kind of weird irrelevance to it. And I think, you know, one of the things I always find about Steven Spielberg is that you start out with a really great idea and it's really fascinating, but then he either hammers it to death or he introduces so much other stuff which is intended to reinforce it but actually doesn't. I mean, I found that even in Schindler's List, for example, which was a film that I liked a lot, but then its details began to deteriorate towards the end, which in a way that took away from the actual substance of what he was saying. So in Close Encounters, I thought this hopeful nature of actually thinking that people from elsewhere in the universe could actually be benign and could actually communicate, it sort of didn't have the impact that it should have had, really, to me. And seeing it this time kind of reinforced that for me. I think that there are other films which actually got a hold of that much better. But of course, all of that is lost in the dust of all the hostility now. That anything to do with off world life is going to kill you.
Or on world life. The Bill, you talked about the family relations, and this sort of came up a lot on social media this week. But also, I mean, I'd thought about this already too, which is that, and Spielberg himself has said that he made this as a very young man. That when he got married and had children, he saw the whole thing a little bit differently. But this is, in addition to being everything that we just talked about, a movie about a guy having a nervous breakdown. As you said, you were wondering about his overall sanity. He is having what appears to be a nervous breakdown. He's got a wife and three kids, and he ultimately makes this decision that there's something more important than that. And he gets, I mean, spoiler, you had 40 years to see this movie. He gets on a spaceship without apparently even a backward thought about
it. Finally,
any of these
we
people.
Got rid of him.
So I don't know. How did that work for you?
Well, I saw the movie with my 16-year-old son. And as we were leaving the theater, I did say to him, wow, you know, kind of messed up the way he just like
Bye.
Took off from his kids in particular, and just kind of just like left them behind without even, you know, even caring about it to the slightest extent. And that was troubling for me. I know we had quite the Facebook argument about this, and people had differing opinions about it. But I did find it troubling, and I did find it somewhat contrary to the overall humanitarian feel and message to the movie. Because after all, like, doesn't humanitarianism have to start in the home, perhaps with your own children?
Although the message I'm getting in all caps from Jonathan McNichol is reminding us that the humanitarianism doesn't start in the home with his wife, Ronnie, played by Terry Garr, who actually, while he's having this nervous breakdown, just packs the kids up in the car and drives away. In other words, he's already been, if you want to get technical about it, abandoned by his wife and family.
As I told Jonathan, she only leaves when he's throwing trees through the window,
yes.
Which if my partner's throwing trees through the window, I think I'm leaving too.
All right. I've met your partner. I don't think she's going to do that. But and then there's like this other little problem, which I had sort of forgotten about, but it's the smooch.
Yeah, I didn't have any problem with the abandonment. Leave your wife, leave your kids, whatever. But why the gratuitous kiss with Barry's mom? He's got enough thought process to smooch on Hot Barry's single mom, but he doesn't say, oh, by the way, can you let my kids know I'm getting on the spaceship? Please, like, that would be wonderful.
This is Steven Spielberg. Front and center, coming up and dotting the I's and crossing the T's. He had to do that. That's one of there's always something that is really significant yet completely irrelevant in toward the end of a Spielberg movie that really sort of either dismantles what has been going on for the previous 2 hours, or it certainly knocks a bit of a hole in it. And it's one of these things about him as a filmmaker. He has this really powerful personal thing about doing that in a movie, and I sort of wonder, where is it going to happen, kind of thing, when I'm watching one of his movies. And I like some of them very much. I mean, I loved AI, but AI had some of its own elements like that too.
It's like those Persian carpets that have an imperfection put into them, just so you know that it's a so if you come out of a movie and say, oh, there was that one thing, I wish he hadn't done that, then it probably wasn't a Spielberg movie. All right, we have to take a break, so we'll have time to recommend some stuff to you on the other side.
Today's show was directed by Jonathan Truffaut and me, Kyone Wolf. The part of Amanda Fish was played by Terry Garr. The part of Bill Curry was played by Lance Hendrickson. On Monday, revisit our analysis of what's really wrong with our healthcare system. And now, back to Colin.
And we're going to make some recommendations to you. Before I do that, I'll say that I am headed off as of the end of the show today I'll be gone for a couple of weeks. I'm going to be visiting the Irish and British Isles for most of that time. But we have all kinds of interesting surprises for you, which are, I guess, not going to be surprises now that I mentioned them. Not only are we going to re-air some of our favorite shows, but Kai and Wolf is going to host two very different shows in my absence. We've got a couple of shows that we've prepared for you that are brand new, including a version of the live show that we did at the Copper Beach Institute about spirituality and music, which involves a lot of musicians performing their music and talking about it. And then a very lengthy, very interesting, I hope, interview I did with John McPhee yesterday, which will be running, I think, on the 28th. I really recommend that, particularly if McPhee's work means anything to you. All right, time to make some recommendations. What have you got, Rebecca Castellani?
So I have one recommendation that's sort of a plea. I've been doing a lot of research recently into this idea of fast fashion. It seems to be popping up all over Instagram, places where they copy trends that are coming out in the runways and have them ready for sale within 24 hours. The fashion industry is actually the second dirtiest industry in the world, second only to big oil. So my plea would be, before you go out to get your cute new outfit from Forever 21, I made it my only New Year's resolution I've ever kept this far. Is on New Year's Eve, I said I was not going to buy anything new this year. So I've shopped exclusively at thrift stores and Goodwill. And I'll tell you what, it is so satisfying and there's such good stuff and you find all sorts of hidden gems. So shop your friend's closet.
She actually has a really cute top on today, which I had sort of...
It is from Goodwill.
Yeah, I had noticed it when I walked in the studio.
This is actually sewn by a sewing student. No tags on it. It was something that somebody made that ended up in Goodwill. So you find some really amazing stuff, great leather goods, all that stuff. Shop your friend's closets, upcycle, but let's all as a society try not to keep... precipitating. Geez, it's been a long day. This problem.
What a great idea. Okay, thank you.
That
thank
makes
you for that
so much
one.
Sense.
Yeah. I have to go to REI and buy some stuff, but then I won't, I won't do it anymore. All right, James.
I was going to tout my favorite book of the moment, which is John Warder's little bright pink book that says on the cover, "Make Trouble." And it's very easy read with lots of drawings and not much text, but it's just so refreshing reading such an iconoclast with some very simple thoughts. And it also fits in with my other favorite book of the moment I've mentioned before, but that is fantastic, Naomi Klein's book, No.
Yes.
That is an incredible book and a real amazing inspiration in a dreadful time.
All right. And Bill Usman.
I'll second the endorsement for the Naomi Klein book. And my endorsement is a new documentary film called Whose Streets, which is about the killing of Mike Brown in Ferguson, Missouri. But actually, it's more about the grassroots activism that arose in reaction to that. So it's both a horribly devastating film, but also in some ways an inspirational and liberating film. And it does something really interesting in terms of where documentary film is going. A lot of it is constructed out of curated cell phone videos from the actual events, which is, I think, going to become a whole new direction in documentary filmmaking.
I would agree with that.
It was at Real Artways. I don't think it's there anymore. I'm sure it'll be available, online.
It's coming to Cine Studio, actually.
I was going to say, perhaps Cine Studio, hint, hint.
We have it, yep.
Excellent.
Hey, do you think you'll get the Close Encounters print, too, that's out now? Or?
It's possible, yes. We're just in the process of discussing that, so we might well play that, yeah.
Because that really is worth, one way or another, seeing in a movie theater.
Yes,
I think it's sort of, one of the things that I forgot to say was that... one of the things that Spielberg does really well, obviously, it's these days graphics have gotten more and more elaborate. He kind of sells us the spaceship through the people looking at it, I think, more than anything else. Mm-hmm. And he just does such a great job with it. All right. So the only thing that I will add to all those recommendations is the thing that we almost talked about on the show this week. It's In Conversation, John Cleese. It's David Marchese, as the case may be, from Vulture.com, which is part of New York Magazine. It's a remarkable, sprawling – interview. The reason that we didn't talk about it is because all of us had very different reactions to different parts of it. There isn't like one thing that everybody's going to react to very differently. But it's a very interesting portrait of what it's like to be 77 and be what John Cleese has always been, what his reactions are to America, which I knew a little bit about having interviewed him earlier this year. But it sort of has like some of everything, but I would be quite happy if I were 77 and I was like John Cleese, except I don't want the thing he's got on his leg right now, which is some box that extracts scunge, as he puts it, from an infection. Other than that, it's all good. John Cleese and Richard Dreyfuss have both been on this show in the last year or so. So that's ultimately just ties everything together. If Joe West would be on next week, we just have the whole universe summed up here. But it's been great to have Rebecca Castellani and James Hanley and Bill Huseman. Thanks to everybody who made the show possible, too. And I will see you guys in a couple of weeks.